If you travel to Jerusalem today, you'll go to the Pool of Bethesda, and you will see it was a long, thin, rectangular-shaped structure, and then a dividing section down the middle. Those are the five porticos.
So it looks like the author of this text had actual first-century geographical details. This isn't an author who is making things up for realistic effect.
Yeah, and you get the identical thing in chapter 9 of John with the Pool of Siloam.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hey there, and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn as we're continuing our exploration of the Gospel of John. I'm Shane Rosenthal, and joining me for this program is a guest we've had on the show before. Dr. Craig Blomberg is professor of New Testament at Denver Seminary and author of numerous books, including Can We Still Believe the Bible, A New Testament Theology, and The Historical Reliability of John's Gospel, which is the book we'll be focusing on during this conversation. Dr. Blomberg, thanks so much for being my guest today on the White Horse Inn.
Thank you for having me.
So as I mentioned at the top of the program here, this year we're walking through the Gospel of John. And one of the things we've been pointing out since we've started out on this trek is that the fourth gospel doesn't appear to be a kind of late fan fiction gospel influenced, you know, by Greek ideas, but rather is a distinctively Jewish text written by a credible eyewitness to the life of Jesus. Is this your conviction as well?
It is.
What are some of the features of John's gospel that have convinced you of this fact?
I think that John has more locations than are mentioned in any other single gospel. He has more references to the geography and the lay of the land and to key people, especially surrounding Jesus' passion, death, and resurrection, which, where they can be tested, all match up very closely with what we know of from first century Israel that fit in with that conviction.
And so you're arguing that this is a historically reliable text written by an eyewitness. So how would it differ, for example, from those spurious later texts, such as the Gnostic Gospels?
For one thing, it's a consecutive narrative. In fact, for all the differences between John and Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John is more strictly chronological by telling us when Jesus attended a certain festival in Jerusalem, or he is feeding the 5,000, but he's the only gospel who tells us it was Passover time. And so we can put together approximately a 3-year chronology for Jesus' life, which you would not be able to do from any other gospel. When you go to the Gnostic texts, you tend not to have narratives at all. You simply have collections of pretty short sayings of Jesus put together, often seemingly without any overarching structure or thematic grouping. A number of the Gnostic texts will have long discourses by Jesus on topics about the nature of heaven, what deities emerged out of earlier deities, types of things that you just don't find in John or anywhere in the New Testament at all.
And very few references or allusions to Old Testament texts, right?
Very few. In fact, going to a text like the Gospel of Thomas, you at times even get what appear to be downright anti-Semitic statements. One of the funnier things, if you have a sense of humor for this kind of thing, is I think it's saying number 114. Simon Peter said, "Let Mary go out from among us, for women are not worthy of life." Jesus replied, "Look, I will lead her that I may make her male, in order that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who makes herself male will enter into the kingdom of heaven." Now, for all the scuttlebutt that the Gnostic Gospels are more feminist and more pro-women, I'm not sure that saying fits.
Right. I mean, when you look at the Gospel of John, it's everywhere alluding to themes in the Old Testament. this is a Jewish text that's very situated, as you say, in first century Palestine with all the geographical indicators and all the temporal markers, whereas the Gnostic Gospels seem to be more esoteric, more Greek in their thinking and their religious worldview, and not a lot of ways to corroborate them because they don't have those temporal or geographical markers, right?
Right. The very first verse in the beginning goes right back to Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens, the earth. In the beginning, the Word was with God. The Word was God. And I don't want to swing the pendulum so far in that direction that somebody turns over the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts and says, well, wait a minute, this was written by a Gentile. How come there are all these Old Testament references here? Gentiles could learn that information, and Luke may even have been a God-fearer, someone who had begun associating with the synagogue before he became a Christian. We don't know that for sure. But once you have some reason to believe that John may have been written by a Jewish person, then you see signs that fit that everywhere.
Yeah, I guess the question would be, what kind of a Messiah is Jesus being presented to be? Is he just kind of a spiritual guru, or is he actually the promised Messiah of the Old Testament religion?
That's right. And in John's passion narrative, there are little added touches that could well have come out of the Gospel of Matthew that emphasizes Jesus as royal Messiah. So he is dressed up in the purple robe and crown of thorns put on his head, and Pilate brings him out and says, here's the man, and then has the placard nailed over him with Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, in multiple languages. So it's clear that for all the differences, especially by the time you get to Jesus' suffering and death and resurrection, there are a lot of points of contact with the other three.
Yeah. Now, so as you know, there are many New Testament scholars out there who would agree with you up to a point in saying that though the fourth gospel is of a completely different character than the Gnostic gospels, it's still the latest of all the gospels. And as such, it reflects later Christian beliefs much more than it does the actual words and deeds of Jesus himself. How would you respond to someone who argued that?
I would say half right. The Gospel of John, if we accept what little early church tradition we have, probably was written in the 80s or 90s at the end of the first century. And some of the distinctives of John can very much be explained by that dating, but not because the theology has developed from something it wasn't earlier. Paul in Romans 9:5 speaks of the Messiah who is God over all, blessed forever, and that was a book written probably in 57, give or take a year. You have in the Synoptic Gospels the story, at least in Matthew and Luke, of the virgin birth, which presupposes that Jesus is a divine Messiah.
Now, you say that in John 5:2, the narrator describes some of the structures there in pre-70 AD Jerusalem that were later corroborated by archaeological digs. Can you go into that a little?
Yeah, the specific reference is to the Pool of Bethesda. And if you travel to Jerusalem today and spend any length of time there and get any kind of a decent tour guide, you'll go to the Pool of Bethesda on the north side of the what once were the temple precincts, and you will see that it was a long, thin, rectangular-shaped structure with a portico crossing over it in the middle, so that you have the four sides that make the perimeter of the entire structure, and then a dividing section down the middle, and those are the five porticos.
And am I right to say that somewhere in the Qumran documents, the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a reference to the name of that pool being Bethesda?
Yes, there is a reference at Qumran. So
it looks like the author of this text had actual first century geographical details and structural details. This isn't an author who is making things up for realistic effect.
Yeah. And you get the identical thing in chapter 9 of John with the Pool of Siloam, which has been identified and discovered on the south side of the Temple Mount. In fact, the current archaeological speculation is that these were most likely by far the two biggest pools, one on the north, one on the south side. What would you do with them? It's where all the pilgrims coming to Jerusalem would have been purified if they wanted to then proceed into the Temple Mount, into the temple precincts, offer sacrifices. And given the number of people coming, especially at festival times, yeah, they have some pretty big pools. Here they were.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned that, in your view, the Gospel of John was written either in the 80s or 90s, but Daniel Wallace has argued that there in John 5:2, the present tense language that he finds there may point to a pre-70 date for the fourth gospel, because he says specifically the narrator writes that there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has the five roofed colonnades. In other words, the structures still appear to be standing at the time of this author's narration. And when the Romans destroyed that city and temple in 70 AD, Josephus later writes that the whole area looked like it was a plowed field. What do you think of that argument that Wallace is making there?
Well, Dan is a good friend, and I respect his understanding of Greek very highly. The counter to that is that in all of the Gospels, but particularly in Mark and John, you have a frequent use of what is called the historic present tense, so that we could see, 50 times in the Gospel of Mark alone, a statement where you're going along in the past tense, and all of a sudden it says, Jesus says, or people see, or so-and-so enters, which makes it that much more vivid. Now, Dan counters. He doesn't find that the simple verb to be uses the historic present all that much. So there are the arguments. I suppose for me, if I have the earliest church tradition that says one thing, though admittedly there aren't a ton of people talking about it, and then I see grammar that can go different ways, including a way that fits with the early church tradition, I'll sort of default to that.
Yeah, that was kind of the conclusion that D.A. Carson ended up. We spoke with D.A. Carson recently. He said the grammar certainly lends that possibility open, but there are other factors that point him to the conclusion that it's written sometime around 85 A.D. or so.
And since he was my supervisor and mentor years ago when we were both young, I dare not disagree with that.
Now, a very liberal scholar by the name of John A.T. Robinson ended up arriving at a very conservative view of the dating of the text of the New Testament after he thought about the significance of 70 A.D. In his book, Redating the New Testament, he writes, "One of the oddest facts about the New Testament is that what on any showing would appear to be the single most datable and climactic event of the period, the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and with it the collapse of institutional Judaism based on the temple, is never once mentioned as a past fact. It is, of course, predicted, and these predictions are, in some cases at least, assumed to be written or written up after the event. But the silence is nevertheless as significant as the silence for Sherlock Holmes of the dog that did not bark." What do you think about his observations there?
I agree that the absence of any reference to the fall of Jerusalem is hugely important. I think it's a very significant argument when it comes to dating a lot of the epistles. When it comes to the Gospels, when a person is writing biographical or historical material about a certain period of time, it is rare to jump ahead to something that would happen 40 years later. So it could be significant, but when the little bit of external tradition that we do have puts John at a later date, I don't find that kind of argument from silence enough necessarily to overthrow what was said.
So do you think that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, or Luke were written before 70 AD?
I do.
Where would you place them, like just a rough sketch?
I am still convinced by the once common view that the book of Acts ends as abruptly as it does because Luke didn't have any subsequent information to write about Paul's imprisonment and house arrest in Rome. And if that is the reason for the end of the book of Acts, then we can't date it any later than 62. It makes sense that the gospel was written before the book of Acts, even if the two were done almost back to back. I am convinced that Luke used the Gospel of Mark, so that requires us to push Mark back. Matthew, I think, used Mark. And as to how much later he wrote, there is not much else to say except by the same arguments that John A.T. Robinson made about predictions. I think Matthew is the one author who has the clearest references, but not in any way written as if they were after the fact. There, I think Robinson makes good sense, and this is sometime before 70.
Now, as you know, many critics have argued that John's account of the resurrection can't be reconciled with the versions we find in the other three Gospels. For example, in Matthew's Gospel, we're told that Mary Magdalene and others arrive at the tomb on the dawn of the first day and see an angel who tells them, "I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he is risen." And then the women run to tell the others. Yet in John's version, Mary Magdalene is there at the site of the tomb a little later, but she seems not to have heard the angel's announcement, since she's there at the empty tomb saying, "They've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." How do you end up reconciling these different accounts of the resurrection?
Well, if I were there, I am not sure that in the distraught state of mind, one person who somebody later can confidently announce it was an angel, but Mark calls it a young man in a bright robe. Seriously? Jesus is raised from the dead? That's the story I'm supposed to believe because one person, I'm not quite sure who they were, announced it. I think I might still be somewhat grief-stricken if that's all I had to go on. I do think it's interesting that you get some hints in John 20 that more is in the background than John explicitly mentions. For example, in verse 2, she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." We who? Only Mary has been mentioned. But if I know the previous accounts, then there's a simple answer to that question. There were other women with her. John just hasn't mentioned it.
So do you think that that's one of the ways of reconciling some of the apparent discrepancies we actually find when comparing the Gospels with one another, since one account might be a highly condensed narrative, while the other version has a great deal more specificity?
Absolutely. And I would add one additional thing, and that is John writing after the other three, when the message about Jesus has spread widely, doesn't feel a need to retell what he knows people already well know. And one of the most interesting examples of that comes in John chapter 3, tucked right into a discussion of John's baptizing ministry in John 3:24, is the little parenthetical statement, "This was before John was put in prison." Wait a minute. If all I know is the Gospel of John, I don't even know that John was put in prison. That story is not told to me anywhere.
Yeah, he seems to be assuming knowledge on the part of his audience.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, you mentioned earlier that in your view, John's Gospel is more chronologically literal. And in his account, Jesus actually comes to Jerusalem many times throughout his three-year ministry, whereas Matthew, Mark, and Luke primarily situate Jesus in Galilee and have him coming to Jerusalem only once at the end of his ministry. So do you think this could be one way of explaining the issue surrounding the cleansing of the temple, since it appears at the beginning of John's Gospel, but at the end of the synoptic accounts? So in other words, if according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus only comes to Jerusalem once, where else are you going to put this event?
That's certainly one option. Another option is that, though it sometimes gets mocked in some circles, that Jesus actually had an incident like this both at the beginning and at the end of his ministry. So there are a number of ways of dealing with that other than saying somebody just got it wrong.
Yeah. Now, in John chapter 11, we encounter the story of the raising of Lazarus. But if this was such a significant event, why do you think it was left completely unmentioned by the other three evangelists? Do you think this is one of the places where we could say maybe John has added some fan fiction?
I do think that the raising of Lazarus is an excellent example of what you have to take into account when you realize that the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, only have Jesus going up to Jerusalem at one time. John 11 is not part of Jesus' final climactic entrance into Jerusalem. Afterwards, he goes away. We read in 11:54, Jesus no longer moved about publicly in Judea. He withdrew to a place called Ephraim, and then time passes, and finally you have the climactic going up to Jerusalem. And if that's all that Matthew, Mark, and Luke decided to tell, then there's no place in their outline for the resurrection of Lazarus. On the other hand, they do have the resurrection of Jairus' daughter. They do have the resurrection of the son of the widow of Nain. Lazarus is slightly more remarkable because he's been dead a little bit longer, but it's not as if the other Gospels don't show Jesus having the power to raise people from the dead.
All right, now, let's transition here. Do you think that John's Gospel differs from the other Gospels on the question of the date of the Last Supper and crucifixion?
I don't.
So how do you resolve the apparent discrepancies that a lot of people end up highlighting?
By reading the text carefully. So we start in John 13. It was just before the Passover festival, verse 1. And then I go to the next thought, verse 2. The evening meal was in progress. What evening meal? Well, the only festival that we've, or the only meal that we've just even alluded to was the Passover festival. Well, why would you think otherwise? You flip all the way over to chapter 18, and you have Jesus being taken from Caiaphas to Pilate. Verse 28, middle of the verse, by now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. I thought we just had the Passover. Oh, well, maybe I was all wrong about what I said back there in chapter 13. Or maybe I am reminded that the Passover was a week-long festival. I think it's also interesting that although John tells a lot of different things about what goes on in conjunction with Jesus last night, he does have the same prediction of Peter's denial. He has the same prediction of Judas's betrayal, as if he is saying, I'm not talking about any different day than the synoptics are.
You're listening to The White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal, and on the line with me is Dr. Craig Blomberg, author of The Historical Reliability of John's Gospel. Professor Blomberg, what's your view of the authorship of this gospel? Do you believe that it was written by John the Apostle?
I think that is still probably the most likely case. There is some uncertainty in some of the early church tradition, not about the name of the author, but about whether there was an elder John, perhaps a disciple of John the Apostle. But that evidence isn't all that strong, and I see no reason to contradict the early church, short of having compelling evidence otherwise.
Now, in John 18:15, an anonymous disciple is mentioned who is known to the high priest and who had authority not only to enter into the priest's courtyard, but also to grant access to Peter, who arrives a little later. So what's your opinion of this disciple's identity? Do you think this is John the Apostle? And if so, how are we to account for his being known to the high priest, even to the point that he could grant Peter access into the courtyard during Jesus' trial?
It certainly could be. You've got five places in the latter chapters of John where you have this strictly anonymous person called the disciple Jesus loved that the church has associated with the Apostle John since early days. But you also have a handful of other places where you just have an anonymous disciple where you might expect a name to appear, but you don't. And if John the Apostle, as the writer, is being consistent in not referring to himself by name, he may be that person that you alluded to in chapter 18. It's interesting. We tend to have a sort of romantic notion, perhaps, of Galilee as a backwater place with rude, unlettered fishermen and farmers. And the ancient reality was much more complex than that, especially in Tiberias, especially in Sepphoris. You had very urbane and urbanized cities. There was a thriving fish industry going up and down the Jordan River. The best fish were consistently said to come from Galilee. And somebody had to provide the elders and the high priests and governors with food. And the food, for the most part, came from Galilee. Citrus fruit came from the plains of Sharon along the Mediterranean Sea. Was John's family one of the suppliers of fish to the high priest's home? It's complete speculation, but it's not beyond the bounds of possibility.
All right. Now, we recently had the opportunity to speak with Richard Baucom, who told us that he was beginning to see signs of hope in the world of New Testament scholarship, and that outdated tools such as form criticism are beginning to be abandoned. But when we spoke with D.A. Carson, he was a little bit more on the pessimistic side. What are your thoughts? Do you think that there's a conservative trend in the world of New Testament scholarship today?
Well, I respect both of those men very highly, and on a whole variety of viewpoints, I am not quite as conservative as Carson or quite as optimistic as Baucom, and I think that would probably be true in this case as well. I have certainly seen signs in my lifetime of all kinds of people taking evangelical scholarship much more seriously than they did when I was a theological student. And I still see a whole bunch of people who don't pay us any attention at all.
All right. So the last nut I want you to try and crack is, what do you think about that scene we find at the end of John 7 and the beginning of John chapter 8, the story of the woman caught in adultery? Do you think that this was original to the fourth gospel, or is it a later addition?
There's no way that it could be original. It is not in the oldest manuscripts. In the manuscripts in which it does appear, as any good modern translation, the ESV has a wonderful extended note there. The NIV does as well. It tells you that in some texts, it actually appears at the end of John's gospel. In some texts, it appears earlier in John. In some texts, it appears at the end of Luke's gospel or earlier in Luke. That is foolproof evidence that this is a story looking for a home that may well be historically true. A scholar as skeptical as Bart Ehrman years ago argued in an article that this probably happened. But that's separate from saying that John wrote it in his original document.
Do you think that identifying this section as a later edition lends credibility to the idea that the Gospels have sort of evolved over time and that various things at one time or another have been added in?
It lends credibility to the fact that that happened twice. And the other place that it happened was the so-called longer ending of Mark. Given the fact that we have close to 6,000 Greek manuscripts and another 20,000 in other ancient translations, the odds of there being any other such passage that has never yet been discovered, and if discovered would have been original, is 0.0000, put as many as you want before you add the one. It's not saying that we might not someday discover a text that had something like that, but the only logical thing to conclude, if such was discovered, was that it was the anomaly and the invention of somebody, because how can you otherwise explain the complete absence of any trace of such a text, not only from the manuscripts we have, but then once you start looking at all the church writers of the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries, you're into at least the hundreds of thousands of references to parts of Scripture. And something vanished without a trace? Highly unlikely.
Now, before I let you go, toward the end of last year, you released a new book titled A New Testament Theology. Can you tell our listeners what this book is about in a nutshell?
It is about the dominant and distinctive themes of each book or author of the New Testament placed in one possible chronological order, demonstrating, I hope, that a major unifying theme of each New Testament book and author is the fulfillment of Scripture, the fulfillment of the promises of God. But along the way, it is also a textbook of the major themes. So if you want to have a better understanding of why Jude even appears in its one little chapter and what it has to offer that nobody else in the New Testament has to offer, you can get that there too.
Well, you've been hearing from Craig Blomberg, the author of The Historical Reliability of John's Gospel, as well as A New Testament Theology, which was just released at the end of last year. Craig Blomberg, thanks so much for being my guest today on The White Horse Inn.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
For more information about our 2019 series Through the Gospel of John, simply head to whitehorseinn.org/John. And there you can submit questions for us to answer on the program, sign up to receive our e-newsletter, or make a one-time donation to help support our efforts. Once again, the web address is whitehorseinn.org/John.